The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
I'm Hugh Hewitt. Today on the Town Hall Review, brought to you in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. This week, the 116th Congress convenes. There are a host of issues that will need to be addressed, but none that are more critical to our nation's long-term interests on the world stage than defense. We'll look at the prospect for defense appropriations in the new House.
We are falling behind in major technologies and weapon systems that we can't afford to fall back on.
We'll also look at the latest provocation from China, a threat to sink two of our aircraft carriers.
I think it would be tempting and dangerous to simply dismiss this as Chinese Communist Party bluster.
From Donald Trump to Brexit and beyond, we've been watching a set of forces dramatically reshaping politics and democracies around the world. John Batchelor joins my New Salem colleague, Sebastian Gorka.
Trump is running for re-election and the Democrats don't have a candidate. All the news that we're getting today comes down to that.
I'm Hugh Hewitt. Great to be with you and Happy New Year. Catch my program each weekday morning live, 6 to 9 Eastern Time and on demand 24-7. Learn more at HughHewitt.com. On Thursday this week, the House and Senate convene for the 116th Congress. There's no shortage of issues that we'll be watching and waiting to see whether or how a divided Congress can address. Border security generally. The wall, more specifically, infrastructure, entitlement reform, health care reform, whatever comes from the Mueller report. And, of course, judges. There are a dozen appeals court judges pending and more than 50 district court nominees waiting for action. But more important, especially over the long haul, how does our nation deal with malign actors and strategic competitors on the world stage? What is our ability to defend ourselves in the new era? And directly related is our defense appropriations. I probably don't need to remind you that Democrats now control the House, and they have a majority on defense appropriations. That's why Democrat votes are so important. That's why I turn to a unique strategic voice in this Democratic majority, Tim Ryan, from Ohio's 13th Congressional District, which includes my old hometown of Warren, was my guest. Now, I want to tell people, you're on the House Appropriations Committee.
Sure.
More importantly, not only are you in the House Appropriations, you're on the Defense Subcommittee. 2 years ago, we approved $700 billion in spending. Last year, $716. The president's request is going to be $750. Tim Ryan, this is your number one job to get this right. Do you think we'll get an appropriations bill out of the House that's near the president's request and over to the Senate?
I hope so. I think we will. I mean, we've got to make the bigger argument here. And here's the problem I see, Hugh, with the 24-hour news cycle that the president gets himself wrapped up in, the constant back and forth, the chaos. We're losing the larger narrative of our relationship in the world with our allies, our relationship in the world with China, and our relationship with Russia. China is coming at us. They are in Africa. They are locking down long-term deals in Africa for raw materials. They're building islands in the South China Sea. They got very detailed long-term programs like their One Belt, One Road, where they're connecting Asia to the Middle East. They've got a Make It in China 2025, where they're really trying to take over manufacturing in the world. They're investing hundreds of billions of dollars in artificial intelligence, additive manufacturing, wind, solar, high-speed rail. And we aren't even acting like we're in a competition with them. And the defense budget, with the technologies that are in there, and look, we've got to audit the Defense Department. We've got to make sure we're not wasting money. But we are falling behind in major technologies and weapon systems that we can't afford to fall back on.
Well, hey, that's music to my ears. Do your colleagues on the Democratic side, because you'll be in the majority now, do they agree with you on appropriations, and will they agree with you in rules, and will it get to the floor and get to the Senate?
Well, we're going to find out. You know, we've got a pretty diverse coalition in the Democratic caucus right now. But again, you know, we have got to make sure every member of the Democratic caucus in the country understand this competition. And if you're in this competition, and China is overtaking us in so many ways, Russia doesn't have quite as strong of an economic hand as China does, but they are playing their hand pretty well militarily, and we've got to compete with them as well. If you don't understand that competition, you're not going to understand the need. One of the provisions we've got to continue to push to you is when we're making things through the Defense Department, when we're signing these big contracts, that this stuff is made in the United States, that this stuff is made in areas that have lost manufacturing, so that the tax dollars aren't just serving a great national purpose with our defense industry and our foreign policy and hard and soft power, but it's also creating jobs in areas that need job creation to happen. What I mentioned earlier about spending defense money in areas that would really benefit, to have $3-4 billion in economic impact and then 800 full-time jobs when it was all said and done in a region in Northeast Ohio that could really use it, that's how you want to be spending your defense money. It meets a national purpose, national defense purpose, but also has economic impact. I hope that happens. We haven't heard. Maybe with the new secretary now we'll get some word. But I'm hoping we move forward with it, not just to authorize the program, but to fund the program.
You know, Dr. Griffin, who's the chief technology officer at the Pentagon, said at CSIS a couple of weeks ago, quote, "I think everybody is aware that the last time we really invested in transformative capabilities was in the Reagan era. We introduced stealth fighters, stealth aircraft. We introduced GPS, precision-guided munitions, high data, encrypted communications, things that were really transformative. We got to get back in that game. I think it starts in Ravenna because we got to be ready to intercept this stuff, hypersonics and all of them."
Yeah, no question about it. I mean, directed energy, there's a lot of technologies that we're behind on and we've got to make investments in. And like I said, whether you're a Democrat or Republican, I think most people want to see that those products are being built and assembled and manned and fixed in the United States to the extent
Amen.
We can do that.
Tim Ryan is at least one Democrat who recognizes that, quote, "China is coming at us," close quote. On the other side of the aisle is a tremendous intellect and a leader we'll be watching for years to come. He also sees the threat from China, Congressman Mike Gallagher from Wisconsin. He joined me on my program to talk about a recent provocation from an admiral in the People's Liberation Army. Now I want to read to you a story that was put out by amp.news.com.au. Sink two aircraft carriers. This is from Australia. Chinese Admiral's chilling recipe to dominate the South China Sea. Rear Admiral Liu Yan has told an audience in Shenzhen that the ongoing disputes over ownership of the East and South China Seas could be resolved by sinking two U.S. supercarriers. Taiwan's Central News Agency reports Admiral Liu gave a wide-ranging speech on the state of Sino-U.S. relations. The high-profile, hawkish military commentator reportedly declared that the current trade spat was definitely not simply friction over economics and trade, but instead was a prime strategic issue. He delivered the speech on December 20th to the 2018 Military Industry List Summit. He declared that China's new and highly capable anti-ship ballistic and cruise missiles were more than capable of hitting U.S. carriers, despite them being at the center of a bubble of defensive escorts. Quote, "What the United States fears the most is taking casualties," Admiral Liu declared. He said the loss of one supercarrier would cost the lives of 5,000 servicemen and women. Seeking two would double the toll. Quote, "We'll see how frightened America is." What do you think about that?
I think it would be tempting and dangerous to simply dismiss this as Chinese Communist Party bluster, because the fact is it's closer to the truth than we want to acknowledge, because the most recent annual report on Chinese military power that the Pentagon puts out stated that the PLA can now use its anti-ship ballistic missiles to attack ships, including aircraft carriers, more than 900 statute miles from China's shorelines. The Center for Strategic and Budgetary Assessments put out a recent report in December saying the Navy's carrier air wing now lacks the range, endurance, survivability, and specialization to carry out the operational concepts needed to defeat great power militaries such as China's. And perhaps most troublingly, the National Defense Strategy Commission report recently sketched out a scenario whereby China undertakes a surprise attack against Taiwan in 2024, and we simply lack the capability to do anything about it, and we lack the willingness to do anything about it because of casualty aversion, as is spelled out in the report you read. And they also state that if the United States had to fight Russia in a Baltic contingency, or China in a war over Taiwan today, Americans could face a decisive military defeat. So to paraphrase the 9/11 report, the system is blinking red right now. And I believe that this is the biggest challenge we face, both in the immediate and over the long term. How we confront a rising China in the Indo-Pacific region will determine what the world looks like for the next 100 years.
Now, there's another article from the BBC this morning. Xi Jinping, that's the president of China, says China must and will be reunited with China. Taiwan will be. In a speech marking 40 years since the start of improving ties, the president of China reiterated Beijing's call for a peaceful unification on a one-country, two-systems basis. However, he also warned that China reserved the right to use force. While Taiwan is self-governed and de facto independent, it has never formally declared independence from the mainland. Beijing considers the island to be a breakaway province, and Mr. Xi's comments are in line with China's longstanding policy. But on Wednesday, Taiwan's President Xi Jinping said the island would never accept reunification with China under the terms offered by Beijing. What do you think is going to happen there? And I've got in my mind, Mike Gallagher, Henry Kissinger's long-stated description of Chinese policy, which was periods of growth followed by a sudden sharp attack on a neighbor.
Yeah, it really is striking the extent to which CCP leaders, and Xi in particular, have abandoned Deng Xiaoping's maxim of hide your strength, bide your time, in favor of combative assertiveness. I think we're sort of reaching that tipping point where they're increasingly brazen across the world, from the militarization of the South China Sea to widespread technology transfer in pursuit of the commanding heights of the global economy to its debt trap diplomacy in developing economies. China is flexing its muscles around the world stage, and it's hard to escape the conclusion that the core motivations, experiences, and goals of the CCP, like those of the Soviet Union in 1946, are inherently irreconcilable with American interests and those of the free world. In other words, they do not believe that they can live with us in the Indo-Pacific. Their core DNA propels them abroad and propels them to push us, you know, east of the Hawaiian island chain. And so this is going to be a long-term competition, and I fear that we are waking up very slowly, too slowly, and we need a combination of things, not only a military buildup, but we need the private sector to wake up. We need companies like Google to have a more constructive relationship with the Pentagon. We need to be able to leverage the assets, the unique assets of our society.
Now, Acting Secretary of Defense Shanahan, who became Secretary of Defense on Monday night, he is an acquisition guy. He's a Boeing executive. He knows this. Do you think we'll finally see the plan for the 355-ship Navy, which in an era of Pacific reach and challenge, along with our underwater submersibles, along with hypersonics, do you think we'll finally see some plans that are rapid deployment plans?
I hope so, Hugh. And I confess I'm working on some initiatives that are not ready for prime time now, what I call Operation Hewitt, which would sort of force the Navy to do exactly this. And I think Congress, even in a divided Congress, really has a role to play here.
Go to townhallreview.com for the rest of the discussion and sign up for our podcast. You'll get the best of talk radio every single day. Our program is coming in today in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. They are preparing grounded leaders who are impacting public policy and serving in the public square. Learn more at publicpolicy.pepperdine.edu. Coming up.
Trump is running for re-election and the Democrats don't have a candidate. All the news that we're getting today comes down to that.
One populist moment when the Town Hall Review returns in a moment. Welcome back to the Town Hall Review. I'm Hugh Hewitt. Populism, nationalism, a rejection of the elites. These are some of the labels and phrases we've heard time and time again to talk about our current political moment. The election of Donald Trump may have been the most dramatic manifestation of what is generally a worldwide phenomenon. Remember the Brexit vote in the United Kingdom in 2016? And the recent and revealing announcement that Germany's Angela Merkel will not seek another term as German Chancellor? And someone you might be less familiar with, the new president of Brazil, Jair Bolsonaro. John Batchelor, another radio host, talked about this moment with my newest Salem colleague, Sebastian Gorka.
Let's go to one of our favorite topics. Your range is without compare, from space policy to, you know, my wife's book on cast iron girders and their use in the New York skyscrapers. But I want to focus on one thing. The president gave a speech, I think it was in Wilkes-Barre, PA, where he first used this phrase of the super elite. He said the so-called elite have failed us, the talking heads, the think tanks, the wonks of this city. They've just come up with the wrong answers for 30 years. You are the new super elite. And I took that as meaning the reinjection of American common sense. How significant is this challenge of a non-policy, non-politician being the commander-in-chief? And will it only be for 8 years, or will his effect be a lasting one? You talk to everybody. What's your prognosis?
My prognosis is the opposition, the resistance, wants a return to the status quo, and the New York Times and the Washington Post and CBS News and Politico and CNN were the masters of the United States and told us what was virtuous and why we were wrong. That status quo, they believe, will come back when they defeat Donald Trump in 2020. That status quo is never coming back. Never.
Why?
Not in 2020, not in 2024. Why won't it come back? Because we're into a world where there are many more possibilities than they understood, than they ever dreamed of. Many more possibilities. Their presumption that if you go to the right schools and marry the right people and hang out in the right cities, that you're going to always be buffered to tell us, the common people, tell us what is the right thing. That was their presumption. Seb, I was educated that way. I'm one of them. So I know. I was educated in the 20th century to fight the Cold War. I was taught Russian. I went to the right universities and the right schools, and I went to the right city, and I went to the right publications. It's never coming back. It's exciting that it's not coming back. We know it. Why do we know it? Brexit.
Yes.
But tell.
This was my next question. So
throwing Angela Merkel out for unknowns is a tell.
Right.
Or Xi Jinping in trouble because he gets up there and bans Winnie the Pooh and the Chinese people laugh at him. That's why the status quo of the big leader and his acolytes is never coming back. And that's an opportunity for us.
Here's my question, my partisan, my selfish question. I saw this from inside when I was in the White House. There are so few people who understand that the China has been broken in the China shop.
Yeah.
Who will represent, who will manufacture the policies for a world in which national sovereignty and representative Republican democracy is back? Because, you know, we use the catchphrase MAGA, and it's great to win elections, but where are the MAGA-crats, if you will? Are we just going to stumble through and find them? Or do you see a new constituency of people who understand the geopolitical changes and are ready to sail on those seas?
Excellent question. It has too many moving parts, so I'll be focused on this. Nationalism versus globalism.
Yeah.
Let's just talk about those two poles, right? Russia and China got there first.
Right.
Putin and Xi saw first. Go to nationalism. It's a uniter. Now, they are malignant, but they get it.
Yeah.
Britain gets it. That's nationalism, what Brexit is. They mock those who led Brexit, and the Remainers all sit around as if any day now the 17th century is going to come back. Okay, fine. Here, we got to nationalism thanks to the election of Donald Trump. Donald Trump is representative of those of us who do not want to be in a borderless world where we have to sacrifice or give up or give back the GDP our children need because we can't use our energy skills.
Right.
We don't want to do that. We're not going to do that. So that's the short answer. We got to it late, but our version is better because we're capitalists. We're good at it, Seb. We make money at it.
but John, when you say the Brits got it, only the 17 million people who voted to leave the EU, look at what's happened in the last 2 years with this abortion of a process.
Yeah.
The
elite
still doesn't get it in the UK, even when people, for those who don't follow British politics, no issue in British history have 17 million people voted on one side of the issue. Never happened before. And the elite still doesn't get it.
It's a joy to watch it happen. It's a joy.
Not if you're in Britain.
All Oxford and Cambridge can do is squeal and point and blame and complain. That's all they can do. They can't stop it.
Yeah.
I don't know whether they're going to go to a second referendum. I don't know whether May will be kicked out first. It's exciting.
Oh, it is. It is. But my fear is, look, I love Phil Bobbitt. His works are amazing. Terror and Consent and his whole argument and his books on the evolution of the Westphalian system. But at the end of the day, states maintain the monopoly on the use of force on a scale that is required in the current world. And also, they're the only people who get to tax other people. So the idea that the nation state is dead, this Fukuyamian idyll, was never going to be true. But when will the elites wake up to it, John? That's my question.
Well, I count on your show as a wingman to my show.
I like it.
To make it very clear.
All right.
That the
Deal.
Status quo is not coming back.
Deal. I can't do long form at 3 p.m, but I'll do my best with guests like you, John. Good. All right. So let's talk about the latest news. The president reached out an olive branch. He's invited right. Nancy and Chuck to the White House, and their response has been, thanks, but no thanks. That's their idea of working together as Americans. What does that bode for the next 2 years? And we have a minute and a half.
Trump is running for re-election, and the Democrats don't have a candidate. All the news that we're getting today comes down to that. That's it.
So are we just going to see a circus on the left? Are we going to see the predicted 36 potential candidates?
Yes, yes, yes. They're disorganized because they don't have a candidate.
So does that mean that we're just going to see 2 years of obstruction? And
yes.
Then in 2020... the House and the Senate and the White House will be in the hands of the GOP?
Yeah, well, I believe that the GOP is in a good position. A re-election is always favorable to the incumbent. Always.
Right.
That's
right.
Just history speaking. I also believe that this particular group of Democrats cannot help themselves from voting for virtue as opposed to electability.
Yeah.
They will ignore the electable. They probably can elect somebody like Joe Biden.
Let me give a formal welcome to Sebastian with warm wishes for many successes within Salem with our fine and loyal listening audiences. Welcome aboard. Listen, follow Sebastian on Twitter at Seb Gorka. That's Seb, S-E-B, Gorka, G-O-R-K-A. Catch him live from 3 to 6 p.m. Eastern on many of the same stations you have been hearing our program on each week. Coming up.
You know, it's not what happens to you, it's how you respond to it.
Congressman Steve Scalise on the shooting that nearly took his life when the Town Hall Review continues in a moment. Welcome back to Town Hall Review. I'm Hugh Hewitt. In June 2017, a lone gunman fired upon Republican congressman preparing for a charity baseball game against the Democrats. Louisiana Congressman Steve Scalise took the worst of it. And he nearly bled to death right there on the field. He details the events of that day and the long, difficult recovery in his book, Back in the Game. He joined me on the Hugh Hewitt Show. Let me ask you, Congressman, to begin with, the reaction to the book. Politics must be a different level of intensity for you after surviving an assassination attempt.
Yeah, you know, I've got a great job. I love doing, you know, the job of representing Southeast Louisiana, but also serving as the majority whip. We just got to pick ourselves up and get back to work, making sure we're fighting for the conservative values we believe in. And, you know, politics is a tough sport, and that's, you know, that's how you deal with things. But, I mean, what I went through was a different kind of tough. But, you know, I'd also focused me, coming that close to death, focused me on what's really important in life. And, you know, I love my family. I focus more on time, especially on the weekends with my family. And but I love my job, and I miss the work that I was doing, working with this president, working to get the country back on track. And I was able to get back to work. And that's kind of what we talk about in Back in the Game is, you know, going from a near-death experience to fighting, learning how to walk again, fighting back to through the recovery to finally being able to go back to work again. And,
Congressman Scalise,
along the way.
Back in the Game is very, very vivid in how hard it is to rehabilitate from wounds like this. But, boy, I think that is going to be inspiring. I know a lot of victims of mass shooting. It's kind of weird, actually, how many I know, and you probably do, too. You know, everyone who was on that field, and you yourself are a victim. But a lot of them need to come back. They have to rehab, and you are the guy. I mean, whenever this happens, you're the guy to say, here's what you focus on and here's what you do. That's a new role, not one you probably ever imagined playing.
No, and a lot of people talk to me about that. You know, and everybody has something different that they experience in life, some kind of downturn or, you know, or difficulty, your friend dies, they get cancer, whatever it is. You know, it's not what happens to you. It's how you respond to it and how you won't fight through it and fight to get better. And, you know, for me, having to learn how to walk again, it was tough, you know, but you've got to just stay focused on what you need to do. You got to listen. In my case, you know, listening to my doctors, listening to my physical and occupational therapists, who were just wonderful people. You know, and I talk about all that in the book. I mean, there's a lot. I still do 2 days a week of physical therapy, just, you know, trying to get to where I don't need to walk with crutches anymore. And that's my next goal. But you have to set goals. You have to work at them. You have to listen to the people who are going to help you. You know, God presents you with people that, you know, that are there to help you get through tough times, whether it's friends and family, whether it's strangers sending support. But, you know, you can get through it, and you gotta focus on getting better. You don't focus on the bad thing that happened. You need to focus on what you need to do to get better every day.
Congressman Steve Scalise, the House Majority Whip, soon to be the House Minority Whip, is our guest. His new book, Back in the Game, is on shelves everywhere. It's in airports everywhere. Back in the Game is also available at Amazon. I am living up to the Frank Luntz rule, Whip Scalise, that you have to say the title of a book 7 times in an interview, Back in the Game, if people want to remember Back in the Game. So I always say Back in the Game again. Let me tell you my favorite part. Your return to Congress. This was a highly scripted and very unlikely to be a surprise. You had to find a loading dock. You had to find an empty hallway. It's kind of fun that it all came together the way that it was.
Yeah, really. It was a lot of cloak and dagger to be able to come back to work. In a way where nobody really knew when I was coming back, because there were a lot of setbacks. And in the book, as you say, Back in the Game, I talk about a lot of the setbacks, you know, and I had been given a discharge date at one point, and we had another setback and an infection that almost took me again. And so you never know. If we didn't want to say, okay, I'm going to come back on the 20th, and then all of a sudden something would go wrong. So when I was able to get discharged and go back to Congress, it was such a highlight for me. To be able to walk back into that chamber. But, you know, I wanted to kind of surprise people and come back when I was able to come back on my own terms. And
now, I got to ask you, there's a controversy around people who say thoughts and prayers in the aftermath of violence. I do pray for people who are the victims of violence, and I pray for people who mock those. But what did you think about prayer for you when you were close to death's door, and when you were suffering through the recovery and had the setback? What do you think about that?
It was incredibly helpful to me to have those prayers. I mean, I pray for people too, like you said, and it is a shame that it's somehow become controversial. And, you know, I can understand maybe some people don't want the prayers, but a lot of other people do. I surely wanted and needed that strength that it gave me to know that other people, even strangers, I mean, friends and strangers alike, were praying for my recovery. And I could feel it, you know, and maybe not everybody does, but I felt it, and it gave me strength. And I thank so many of those people who prayed for me, because it really did matter. And you know, if somebody doesn't want those prayers, you know, that's their prerogative. But a lot of other people do, and it shouldn't be controversial. But, you know, that was one of the things that we saw, and it surely helped me.
Our program is coming today in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. It's America's most unique graduate leadership programs offered on Pepperdine's breathtaking campus in Malibu, California. Learn more at publicpolicy.pepperdine.edu. Coming up, a look at the Nike decision to make Colin Kaepernick their spokesman.
The idea that Nike would reward him not for his athletic excellence, but for 100% his politics represents everything that is wrong with the intersection of sports and politics.
The Town Hall Review returns in a moment. Welcome back to Town Hall Review, brought to you in partnership with ADF, the Alliance Defending Freedom. I'm Hugh Hewitt. Left-wing politics have been a staple in Hollywood for a long time. It has infected much of the media for nearly as long. One rare reprieve was the world of sports. But ESPN changed the game when they started the first 24 hours a day sports station. At first, sports remained sports. But as time went by, the networks placed some left-wing personalities in front of the camera, and eventually their politics spilled out into the broadcast. Clay Travis wrote of this phenomenon in his book, Republicans Buy Sneakers Too. He spoke with host Dennis Prager.
And he's the author of a brand new book, Republicans Buy Sneakers Too. That's a good one. How the Left is Ruining Sports with Politics. I was just talking prior to having you on about Nike making Colin Kaepernick a poster boy. And people don't realize the guy wore police pictured as pigs on his socks during a football game. Is this something that this would be something that you describe in your book, I assume?
Yes, certainly. It was actually during practice, but
I know that. Games, yes,
they have to wear specific team issued socks. But yeah, he wore socks depicting police officers as pigs to San Francisco 49er practice. And even worse than that, I think, in the wake of his protest, he tweeted that police were modern day slave catchers, which is, just, I think, beyond inflammatory. And so the idea that Nike would reward him not for his athletic excellence, but for 100% his politics, to me represents everything that is wrong with the intersection of sports and politics in our modern culture.
Do you remember the sports writers' hysteria over the Washington Redskins name?
Yeah, and then they had the report that came out that determined that something like 90% of Americans did not care at all about the name of the Washington Redskins.
Of Native Americans.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah. Yeah, exactly.
That's the key.
It was exaggerated because certain members of the sports media had decided that they were offended, and they used their personal opinions as a proxy for what they believed the nation should also believe. And I think, you know, the book really dives into to a lot of illustrations of stories along those lines where things have absolutely no connection to the field at all. And in fact, it's sports media and sports journalists deciding to interject their own personal politics into the way that stories are covered.
I read about sports more than I actually watch them. So, in effect, I follow sports, but in an odd way, I read about it. And until, you know, the playoffs, and it's just the way I care about sports, but I don't have the time to watch whole games as a general rule. And only in the last, I'd say, 10 years did I become aware of the fact that there's no more genre of left-wing writing and unanimity of thought than among sports writers.
Yeah, there's a stat in the book that I think blows people's minds. The quote-unquote, you know, mainstream media donated 27 times as much money to Hillary Clinton's campaign as they did to Donald Trump's campaign. So the media that covers politics and the media that covers everything kind of surrounding politics was 27 times as likely to support Hillary Clinton as they were Donald Trump. I don't think that surprises anyone. Here's a stat that's going to blow your mind. ESPN employees donated 270 times as much money to Hillary Clinton as they did to Donald Trump. So ESPN standing alone was 10 times as left-wing biased as the overall media as a whole. It's a statistic, again, if you look at federal election returns, that blows a lot of people's minds. We all know, I think, in general, how slanted the media can be in the way that they perceive and report on issues surrounding politics. Imagine what would happen in the world of sports if you had people donating 270 times as much money to Hillary Clinton as to Donald Trump.
So we were talking about the left-wing blanket that covers sports writers. So I, in my naive way, I don't think of myself as naive, but I really was surprised when it dawned on me that I couldn't find one outlier among sports writers. They were all leftists, and they all injected their leftism into their columns. So I have a theory, but I rather not offer it. Do you have a theory? as to the unanimity of left-wing thought on among sports writers?
I think a big part, and I wrote this in the book, I think a big part is that that there is a fear, more so than anywhere else, of being called racist associated with writing about sports. Because the audience who is writing about sports, by and large, if you've been in press boxes, a lot of white men, right? And I think the only way you lose your job in that respect is by saying something that is considered to be unacceptable from a racial perspective, because so many athletes that you're covering are black. And so I think part of it is maybe not even 100% real. I think there is a fear of stepping outside the bounds of acceptable discourse. And I think some people are espousing talking points that they don't even necessarily agree with, because they're afraid if they say something a little bit outside the lines that they will then end up as a target online. So I think it's both that there is a tendency for that for left-leaning sports writing to exist in the same way that there would be in, you know, most sports writers went to college, most sports writers are English majors, things like that. I think that tends to predispose. But then I also think, unlike in other elements of opinion where having a difference of opinion is acceptable, I think there's a lot of people who are just terrified of getting in the crosshairs of the of sort of the PC mob that exists on social media today, and so they don't say what they actually believe.
I agree with everything you said. I'd like to add my theory now. I wanted to hear yours first. I have this theory with regard to sports writers and Hollywood actors. I think that a lot of these people do not think what they're doing is important. Writing about sports to many sports writers is fun, is a way to make a living, is interesting, but it's not ultimately significant.
I want to talk to you for a moment about a group I've done work with for years, ADF, the Alliance Defending Freedom. You've seen how your freedom is under attack, but if you act now, you can protect your family today and generations to come. Go to townhallreview.com to find out how you can join Alliance Defending Freedom to help ensure the opponents of freedom don't dictate your future. That's townhallreview.com. Coming up.
Same with actors. I acted in a movie, but that's not important. I want to be important.
More with Clay Travis in the final segment of the Town Hall Review in a moment. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Town Hall Review. I'm Hugh Hewitt. Colin Kaepernick, what he did on the football field, what he's done recently with Nike, is really just one example of a broader trend. These professional athletes, these actors, these entertainers, they want to be somebody more than they already are, and sometimes they're a lot. Let's return for a few moments of Clay Travis with my colleague Dennis Prager.
Same with actors. I acted in a movie, but that's not important. I want to be important, so I'm going to speak out on the great issues, and I'm going to take a great moral position, which costs me nothing, because I'm saying exactly what every other actor or every other sports writer is saying. I think that that's the psychological underpinning. Now I get to say something important.
I think there's a lot of truth to that. I think also as they age, I think it gets more difficult to take a job of a sports writer seriously. When you are in your 20s and you're in your 30s and you're within hailing distance of the players, and maybe even in your 40s, but by the time you're 54 years old and you are asking an 18-year-old what he thinks about something, I think a part of you is thinking to yourself, you know, the underwear that I'm wearing right now is older than this guy that I'm interviewing. And so I think it's just, you know, the great line that sports writing and the sports section in the newspaper was the toy chest of life. And I think at some point, some of these sports writers decide, I'm too old to be doing this, and they get bogged down in larger stories. And I'll be honest with you, I'm 39. I've been in a lot of press boxes now. And so the actual game that takes place, it's relatively rare in this day and age when something unique happens in a game that needs to be immediately written about compared to when you were younger. I think about it now from my kids' perspective. You know, we watched that Texas A&M LSU game that went to seven overtimes and ended 74-72. It was the most remarkable game he had ever seen. It was a remarkable game for me
but I've seen a lot more games than him. So I think as you add more games to your overall repertoire, the significance of individual games and maybe even what you do for a living starts to diminish.
You've added substance to my theory that I never thought of it that way. You're right. It's a big thrill when you're 25 and you're in a press box, or 35 maybe. But at 50?
Yeah, and you get to cover a big game. I mean, yeah. I remember the first time I was in a press box and I got to cover a game that mattered. It was like, wow, you know, I am relevant. My you know, career choice has been in some way validated by my presence in this press box. And then after 20 years later, when you've been in there for a little while, you start to become a little bit, I wouldn't want to say jaded is necessarily the play, but I think that happens for anybody if you do the same job.
Well,
over and
you
over
know,
and over.
You have a reputation as a very thoughtful guy.
Thank you for joining us for this edition of the Town Hall Review. Catch up on earlier episodes at our website, townhallreview.com, and sign up for our daily dose of the best in talk radio. Special thanks to executive producer Russell Shubin, producers Charlie Richard, David Posian, Michael Cook, Adam Ramsey, and Generalissimo Dwayne Patterson. Let me say thanks once again to our sponsors, the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy and ADF, the Alliance Defending Freedom. Thanks for joining us.
Three-star General Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.